Welcome back to the program. Over the years, we've engaged in many wars. The war on poverty, the war on drugs, the recent war on terror, and in 1972, Richard Nixon launched a war on cancer, a war that some said would be won by the turn of the century. Obviously, that war is not won, and in some respects, we are just at the starting gate. New treatments to take advantage of new genetic research is beginning to take hold. The old paradigm of poisoning cancer to death is finally running its course, yet cancer today is growing exponentially. It's estimated that 1 in 3 will be directly touched by cancer. It's becoming the number one killer in America. But with all we know very little about its history and origins. Like too many wars, we are too often fighting against an enemy we do not fully know or understand. We're going to talk about this with my guest, Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's a cancer physician and researcher. He's assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician at Columbia University, New York University Presbyterian Hospital. He's a Rhodes Scholar, a graduate of Stanford and Oxford and Harvard Medical School. It is my pleasure to welcome Siddhartha Mukherjee to talk about his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. Siddhartha, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. You argue that when you set out to do this, that you really found a gap in the literature about cancer, in the books about cancer, in terms of really defining what it is that we're fighting against.
Exactly. I mean, I felt to a large extent that, of course, there's a long list of books about cancer, but they tended to be of the either very technical or of the kind of self-help variety. And for me, really my book was inspired by a question that a patient had asked me, which is she wanted to know what she was battling. And it seemed to me it was a very elemental question. And I was then a fellow just starting my training in cancer medicine, but I was really, I was really stopped in my tracks by that question, because here was something that would touch all of our lives, and yet, as this woman was asking me, we knew so little about it. Aside from, as I said, the self-help variety or the technical books, right. I wanted to write a history which was more comprehensive than that.
And how did you make the connection between realizing that you wanted to understand this larger history of cancer and how that would work for you as a young doctor coming to grips with the illness itself and in treating it?
Well, I mean, I started keeping a journal. I had certainly not imagined that I would be launching this book project. I started keeping a journal while I was training, and the journal kept getting bigger and bigger. And there were important decisions about the book. I mean, for instance, should this be written like a standard kind of history, which is more linear, which is in which the characters are sort of historical characters. Instead, I decided that as I was writing the journal, I felt that my experiences, my struggles, my own, my disappointments, my failures should become part of the book. It should become woven into the book. And also, I felt that the structure need not be linear. We could move around in time, so that what you get at the end of it is a kind of narrative history.
Mm-hmm. At the center of this story is really Sidney Farber. Talk a little about him.
Sidney Farber was a complex character. In a fundamental sense, Sidney Farber is really known to us because of two discoveries, and they're quite separate but linked with each other. The first discovery is a more traditional one, which is that Sidney Farber was one of the first people to discover chemotherapy. He collaborated with a chemist of Indian origin who was working in New York, and Sidney Farber became interested in treating acute lymphoblastic leukemia, a form of cancer which is very aggressive, predominantly affects young children, and which was absolutely incurable. It was lethal in the 1950s. So Sidney Farber became interested in this variant of leukemia, and he stumbled upon a chemical therapy which launched off a long process that would ultimately end in the cure of acute lymphoblastic leukemia in the mid-1960s. Now, but the second discovery is the one that really predominates in my book, which is that along with Mary Lasker, starting in the 1950s, Sidney Farber would launch an advocacy effort around children's cancer and then around cancer in general, and therefore he would become a political advocate. He would become one of the several lobbyists to ask Richard Nixon to launch the war on cancer. And it was the second role which also impressed me, this idea that you could convert from a scientist to an advocate for a disease, and that was Sidney Farber's very central role in this history.
Talk about that transition for him, how he went from being a research scientist to becoming an advocate, and obviously the role that Mary Lasker played in that.
You know, Sidney Farber, as I said, having discovered this chemical in collaboration with several others, he found that he could send leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, a very aggressive variant of cancer, into remission. And he subsequently followed that up by finding other chemicals that would send other cancers, in particular a kidney cancer called Wilms tumor, into remission. And this happened in the 1950s. So he was becoming a kind of leading front. He was leading the front in cancer research, but he was still primarily a physician and a scientist, you know, in Boston. But then he began to wonder whether he needed a larger platform to encourage more research, because he felt that, you know, hundreds of such chemicals would be around the corner, and that the cures of many forms of cancer would be around the corner. Again, this is a time when the polio vaccine had changed the landscape, the geography of polio in America. The antibiotics had changed the landscape and the geography of infectious diseases. So Farber said, well, you know, that must be the case with cancer as well. We must be able to find chemicals that will kill cancer cells and spare normal cells. But then he began to become more and more interested in fundraising. And in fact, his first big experiment in fundraising, and I'm calling it an experiment, was the Jimmy Fund. People in Boston and other parts of the nation are familiar with the Jimmy Fund. Mm-hmm. And this was a children's cancer fund. And just the quick story behind Jimmy Fund is that Farber was trying to look for an anonymous mascot or an anonymous icon for children's cancer. And he finally found someone who would fit the bill, and he was a child of Swedish immigrants called Einar Gustafsson. So Farber rechristened him Jimmy, in part to protect his anonymity, but also to make him, you know, Jimmy next door. And therefore, that was the birth of Jimmy Fund. And it was from the Jimmy Fund that then Farber leaped, in collaboration with Mary Lasker, into the large arena of the war on cancer.
There was also this leap that was involved in this, in believing that somehow, particularly in the 70s, that a magic bullet could be found, that there would be one thing that would cure cancer.
Right. There's a very famous quote. Isaiah Fidler, who's a very respected oncologist, was quoting others when he said that, you know, the 1970s, it was called one cause, one cure. In other words, that everything about cancer, the various manifestations, would somehow suddenly find themselves lumped into a deep singular cause. Perhaps it was viruses of various forms, it was thought to be then. And there would be one cure. It would be some combination, for instance, a cocktail of chemicals, and it would be different cocktails of chemicals for different cancers. But in general, that solution would be true, and all cancers would become curable, much like lymphoblastic leukemia became curable in about 70 to 80% of the cases.
Of course, we would find that that was certainly not going to be the case. When was the realization that, in fact, we weren't going to find this magic bullet?
Well, the realization came slowly, and the disappointments began to pile up, particularly in the 1970s, just after, as you know, the war on cancer was declared, you know, 1969 to 1971 was the most active phase, culminating in the National Cancer Act. It was thought that a decade from that, you know, certainly by the early 1980s, we would have found a cure for all cancers. There was an amazing amount of optimism, a kind of almost hubristic optimism in the air at that time. And so people thought, well, it was just around the corner, and we just had to find, it was like a, you know, there were many locks, and we just had to find the right keys, and if we had many keys, that everything would open up. But the disappointments began to pile up, and by the mid-1980s, it was becoming clear that the solution was not going to be so simple. Now, what's interesting is clinicians knew for a long time, and even researchers knew for a long time, that there was a diversity in cancers. But the level of diversity, how different they are, was only apparent once the cancer genomes got sequenced, once we began to sequence the genes. And I go through this a little bit in great detail in my book. Just to give you one a recent example, I saw a woman last week in my clinic who had two breast cancers. She had one and then had a second in the same breast. And the two cancers were about 4 centimeters away from each other. And yet, if you looked at those cancers, even the simplest genetic test, the two cancers in the same breast, 4 centimeters from each other, do not resemble each other. This is in the same woman. So now, extrapolate that into thousands of women who have thousands of variants of breast cancer, and you can figure out that the genetic diversity, and therefore the behavioral diversity of cancers, is enormous.
When did we realize, and certainly smoking is arguably one of the penultimate examples, that in fact there were external factors that played a large role in activating these cancers?
So, as I point out in the book, this realization came very early, but it was largely neglected because there weren't sufficient examples of them. So in the 1700s, in the late 1700s, a surgeon named Percival Thott discovered that there was a predominance of scrotal cancers in chimney sweeps in England. Now, this was a time when there were lots of chimneys in England and certainly lots of sweeps. In fact, Percival Thott's hospital itself had had 17 chimneys. And so I can imagine that there were lots of sweeps going up and down his own hospital clinic. But nonetheless, Percival Thott discovered that there were chimney sweeps and they had a link with scrotal cancer. And Pott began to wonder whether some component in chimney soot, was the carcinogen in that case. But it wasn't really until several decades and even centuries later that we really figured out the connection between various exogenous substances, and tobacco, as you said, is one example of one, and the connection with particular forms of cancer.
Well, we now know, there are, although so many different types of cancer, as you've been saying, there are some seminal ideas, and one of which we've learned now is how the genes get activated in the cells is really a key ingredient of all of these kinds of cancers.
Activated or inactivated.
Right.
I gave the analogy in the book to a cancer cell. So think, for instance, of a normal cell. A normal cell is like an engine, which has an accelerator and a brake. And when I say engine, I mean cells divide. If cells didn't divide, of course, we wouldn't grow as organisms, and in fact, we would die. Our physiology has a grow or die decree written into it. If we don't grow, we begin to die. So cells have this engine driving their proliferation, their growth forward, and they are accelerators and brakes such that the growth occurs under appropriate circumstances, then it stops under other circumstances. Now, in a cancer cell, the accelerators have been permanently jammed on, or the brakes have been broken. They have been inactivated, and therefore these cells can't stop dividing. Now, that fundamental realization was fully elucidated, I would say, between 1973 and 1983. In that decade, by the end of that decade, this theory of cancer, of accelerator and brake genes being activated and inactivated, was becoming quite apparent.
And given the complexity of that, given the complexity of the genetic operations that go on, it's amazing that there isn't more abnormality.
In fact, one could say that there are really two kinds of questions in that question. One of them is, well, why aren't we exploding with cancer all the time?
Right.
Given the fact that if our cells were fragile, well, part of the answer is evolutionary. So evolution has built in, every cell has built into itself several backup mechanisms such that even when one accelerator fails, there are others that work. And when a cancer cell ultimately arises, it's not just that, you can tip off one single gene. Typically, cancers have multiple genes that are changed, altered. Some cancers may have up to 100 genes that are altered. Now, what's important is that not all 100 of them are relevant. Only 4 or 5 of them might be really driving the aberrant behavior of the cancer cell. So I said before, we talked about the enormous diversity of cancer cells. Well, you could say, well, it's so diverse that the problem is unsolvable, that you'll never get any medicine to ever attack a cancer cell. That's not true. Because although there might be hundreds of genes that are mutated, that are changed, that are altered, only certain ones might be the critical points, might be the critical junctures, and if you found mechanisms to attack them, then you could actually incapacitate the cancer cells and thereby treat cancer. And that's the challenge, really, today. It's an enormous scientific challenge, which is to figure out, now that we know quite a lot, not everything, but quite a lot about cancer genes, what is the next step? How do we convert this knowledge into treatment? I think it's one of the seminal scientific problems of our generation.
And in many ways, it seems that we're ahead of the curve on the knowledge side, on the information side, but translating that into treatment is still where the bulk of the work has to happen.
That's right. But there's no way that you can do that. One thing that we've learned, I think, and that's one of the lessons of the book, very seminal lesson of the book, is that in the history of cancer, I mean, we got a lot of mileage, I think, in discovering medicines without really knowing how and why they work. So, for instance, just to give you one example, aspirin was discovered, and it was only later found how aspirin works. So it's not necessary in the invention of medicines to know how medicines work. Sometimes serendipity tells us that a medicine works, and we only figure out afterwards. Now, that process has slowly ground to a halt in cancer. The next step forward rely on really understanding the fundamental mechanisms of how cancer cells work and using that knowledge to create a next generation of medicines.
And this is the kind of stuff that's going on with things like Gleevec and Herceptin now.
Exactly. Gleevec and Herceptin are examples of treatments that could not have arisen unless some fundamental features of the cancer cell were deciphered. Just to give you the example of Gleevec, just to continue that example, Gleevec was discovered by really uncovering the basic clockwork of a leukemia cell, the entirety of the work, you know, when does that clock start? It probably starts in the 1970s. It probably starts the first discovery of the molecular aberrations in the form of leukemia that's used, that Gleevec is used on. That probably took about 35 odd years. Now, again, let's not be nihilistic about this. A more recent example, we went in the case of melanoma, I'm thinking of a particular variant of melanoma, we went from understanding the aberration, the molecular aberration, to treatment in about 3 to 5 years. So it can be done much faster, but we just need to do it.
In what ways has the war on cancer and the history of cancer that you've been talking about, in what ways, if any, has it influenced the culture of other kinds of medicine?
Well, the most classic example I can think of is one in which it influenced the way AIDS advocacy worked. And what's interesting is that, in fact, it came back. So, in other words, the early AIDS advocates learned some things from patient advocates around cancer, and this was in the 1980s. The real throes of the AIDS epidemic in America, at least, was in the late 1980s. So the AIDS activists learned a lot about advocacy, but of course they took it to another level. They moved it to the next level. What's interesting is that later this process would come full circle. And as I tell in my book, the breast cancer advocates learned back from, for instance, from various AIDS advocacy groups how to politicize, how to campaign, and how to move the pace of medicine. So there's an incredible full circle quality about learning from each other.
And has the business of advocacy with respect to different kinds of cancer and the overall, has that advocacy made a difference?
I think it has. I think it absolutely has. Now, you know, one has to be careful about titrating advocacy, I think. So, in other words, unfortunately, with the economy going in the direction it's going, there's a sense that cancer advocacy becomes a zero-sum game. And by that I mean, if you give a dollar to prostate cancer, that must mean you're taking a dollar away from breast cancer. Well, it's not as simple as that, and just to give you one, again, a classic example, coming back to Gleevec, it turns out that Gleevec not only treats leukemia, but it treats some other forms of cancer which are not leukemia. The one I'm thinking about is a sarcoma, a gastrointestinal tumor, which has no resemblance, at least at a superficial level, has no resemblance to leukemia. But at a deeper molecular level, they're actually quite similar in their pathways are quite similar. Now, in other words, if you said to yourself, you know, every dollar given to leukemia research is a dollar taken away from sarcoma research, that would be a mistake, because in the case of Gleevec, in fact, this medicine treats both those tumors. So I think one needs to be wise about the nature of advocacy. Certainly, particularly around breast cancer, these campaigns have played an important role in motivating physicians and scientists in bringing to taking a disease that was once whispered about and making it a huge public, raising public consciousness around it. But one has to be a little bit careful about, you know, creating complete silos around advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your own experience, because woven through this whole book is your own experience as a doctor coming to grips with this illness, and the degree to which understanding the history has really helped you as a clinician.
The first thing I think is that it's a very humbling history, and so it reminds us as clinicians reminds me as a clinician to look back into the past so that we can understand the future and hopefully not repeat the mistakes of the past. There is a quality in science and in medicine of recapitulating the past. We're constantly trying to have a conversation with the past in all our disciplines. I say at some point in the time in the book, I say that, you know, we think about historians being obsessed with history, but of course scientists are perhaps more deeply obsessed with history, because science is a continuous conversation with the past. Every time I do an experiment in my laboratory in New York, I'm really having a conversation with someone who did a similar or a prior variation on that experiment 5 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe even 50 years ago. So I think there's a quality in which if you look back in the past, you can really understand the future. It's a really critical moment to understand the future of cancer. So I think that's going to be really instructive.
And how does that impact looking back on Farber's work, for example, and even the degree to which chemotherapy is still used today and seemingly primitive in some respects?
Well, it's important to remember that there's a quote in the book in which Bruce Chabner, who was a personal mentor of mine and a very instrumental player in the development of early chemotherapy, he says to Rose Kushner, the breast cancer advocate, he says, you know, if I could, I would rather not use chemical poisons. We know that there's a limitation. But you can't tell a woman with breast cancer who was in the clinic in 1972, you can't tell her, well, come back to me in 10 years, and I'll, you know, let me do my research and figure out what the better medicine is, because she has breast cancer now. So there's a balance, there's a quality in which being a physician, you have to respond to the here and now, to work with the tools that you're given, while scientists carry on the work in the laboratory to make the next generation of medicines possible. Now, making a distinction between physicians and scientists, of course, they can be the same person. You know, the woman who is leading the charge in the clinic against breast cancer may also be the woman who is the great scientist finding cures for breast cancer in her laboratory, in a pharmaceutical company or an academic center. But that said, the physicians, the urgencies experienced by the physician are different. I tried to be sympathetic to those urgencies, tried not to say that, you know, how foolish it was in 1950 or 1970 to imagine that, you know, poisons would eliminate cancer. For that time, the idea was very much optimistic, but very much present.
And of course, language plays a big role. Talking about breast cancer again, you talk about radical mastectomies and that was the treatment of choice for so long, and language played a role in that.
Absolutely. And again, this comes back to the conversation that you and I were having about how physicians and scientists think aloud. The nature of our thinking is by thinking aloud and thinking aloud and writing, either papers or books or some kind of academic communication, we're actually writing ourselves, are writing our thoughts down. So just to give you that example, the radical mastectomy, the word radical in the word radical mastectomy really comes from the word radical in the sense of root, the same word, in fact, that gives rise to radish, because it's a root vegetable. But radical in this case means was a reference to the idea of digging cancer out by its roots. But, of course, the word radical also happens to mean brazen and aggressive and so forth. And the word radical mastectomy, the phrase radical mastectomy, became a kind of lodestone. If you were a woman in 1945 and you were given the choice between a radical mastectomy to completely eliminate your cancer versus a conservative mastectomy, I mean, how would you possibly not choose the radical approach? Take out all the cancer from my body, you know, a woman would tell her surgeon. Of course, it took 90 years to figure out that it wasn't until the 1980s that we figured out that this so-called radical surgery on the breast was no better than conservative surgery. But the words became a trap. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, finally, the overlay to all of this is the dramatic increase in the number of cancer cases that we're seeing.
Yes, and there are several reasons for that. I go through this again in greater detail, but to summarize it quickly, number one, the population is aging overall, and many cancers are age-related. Not all. Childhood lymphoblastic leukemia is a disease that affects children, but cancers are generally age-related, and therefore we've seen an increase. New carcinogens are coming out. Smoking is one great example. We're still living through the rise in lung and lip and throat cancer because of the result of the increase in smoking that continued right through the mid-1950s into the 1960s, and cancers happened 30 to 40 years later. So we're still seeing the long tail of that epidemic. And finally, we're better at detecting early tumors, and therefore, to somewhat artificially, will seem that the cancer incidence is rising, but that's only because we're becoming better and better at detecting earlier and earlier forms of cancer.
Siddhartha Mukherjee, his Pulitzer Prize-winning book is The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. Siddhartha, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.